There's no ouzo talk without a bottle of ouzo, which is why we love the Greek Providor. Get a real taste of the very best produce that Greece has to offer. From olive oils and delicious artisan sweets, to unique spirits, earthy herbs and memorable wines. Visit thegreekprovador.com.au to see their amazing range. The Greek Providor, proud sponsors of the Ouzo Talk podcast. Craving something sweet? Head to Bay Vista Dessert Bar at Brighton Le Sands. Treat yourself to mouth-watering desserts, cakes, sweet and savory crepes, waffles, ice creams, and much, much more, all overlooking Sydney's iconic Brighton Beach. And now, also at Parramatta. Visit bayvista.com.au or drop on in for something sweet. Bay Vista Dessert Bar, proud sponsors of this episode of Ouzo Talk.
Sound is.
Nick, we've had some eerily similar experiences the last few weeks to do with your parents and my grandparents, right?
We have, mate. We have. I couldn't believe what you told me today, but I think you better share it with the audience.
Well, look, just to recap, I mean, just a few weeks ago, you were saying how your mum asked you to take out a fridge, and guess what? I was asked to do the same today for my grandparents. I was having flashbacks thinking, far out, what's going on here?
Have I heard this before?
Yeah. Right? I'm like, are you guys serious? They're like, yeah, the fridge gone, kaput.
Mate, it's a Greek thing, honestly. Council pickup was coming.
Yeah.
That's what Greeks do, check out the old fridge.
Well, no, this was a special request. This wasn't a council pickup job. This was, we're putting it out there and they had to call the council to come and pick it up. So, yeah, we got roped into doing that today. But, you know, it doesn't stop there, though. We had another incident.
What a classic. It was, red alert at my house.
Yeah.
Got the phone from my mum. Oh, something's up. Quick, you got to come over. Emergency. Damn it, mum. Her bloody my sat box, where she listens to all the Greek shows, was disabled. Couldn't work. So she hadn't been listening to Greek shows for a week.
Yeah.
What a disaster.
No. Well,
and you had the same thing.
Well, yeah, while I was there tending to the fridge, they started mentioning the MySat as well. My Yaya's really upset. She's like, oh, pane ola ta kanalia. I can't watch TV. Que ti tha gini. Irtho adherfosu. He couldn't fix it. This, that, and the other. And I'm like, hang on a second. Let me call Nick one second. It might be the same problem. And lo and behold, exactly the same thing.
Classic. That was so funny. You know what the funny thing is? My mum has told everyone now. So I'm getting calls now from, not my aunties, my cousins.
Yeah.
So they're telling their kids, telefono to Nico, ring Nick.
Yeah, Nick knows everything.
He knows how to fix it. So maybe we should do a community announcement.
Public service announcement. Just call MySat. Don't go to the Greek section. Pick one of the other options.
Option four. Yeah, so definitely option three was for Greeks, and you're on hold and never answer it. Go to option four and tell them you need to get it fixed. And they'll give you some formula to press. So
there you go. Don't panic.
Don't panic. It'll get fixed. And you don't have to take your box to Burwood, which originally was my request. Yeah.
Well, I think we're going to have to because their one is pretty old. Like, they've had it for years. So I don't think I'm going to... I'm going to go to Burwood.
So good luck to all those Greek Australians out there who've got that MySat box.
You're welcome. Anyway, okay, look, enough of that. Look, I mean, let me ask you a question. Would you consider yourself to be religious?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
You do go to church, don't you?
Yeah, but you don't have to go to church to be religious.
Sure, say. Of course.
But look, it's part of our culture. So if you call that being religious, I guess probably.
Mm.
Yeah. What about yourself?
To some extent, like most Christians, struggle with our own faith at certain points.
I know what you mean though, because we are logical thinkers and we do like to question everything. And sometimes we don't have those answers.
Mm.
But we have a great person in the room that can answer some of those for us today, hopefully.
We do. And look, obviously, we're going to be talking about the Greeks and Christianity today and the Bible, obviously. And to do that, as always, we've enlisted the help of an expert because us boofheads just couldn't do it justice, could we?
No, we tried, but no, we've got bringing the big guns.
Although we have had some pretty good discussions about this topic in the past, haven't we?
We've been trying to do this episode for how long? At least, what?
A year?
A year?
6 Probably months, a year, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's been a while, but I'm just glad we finally got someone that can assist us with it.
So our guest today teaches Islamic studies at Western Sydney University, ancient Greek religion and myth at the University of New South Wales as well. He holds a PhD in the sociology of religion from Pantheon University of Social and Political Sciences, Athens and Greece, and a PhD in studies in religion from the University of Sydney. He has been teaching at a number of universities, both in Australia and overseas, since 2002. His specialization is in the political phenomenology of early Christianity, patristics, Byzantine philosophy, the history of religions, and Indigenous Australian studies. He's authored and co-edited more than 10 books as well. Joining us in the studio today, Vasilis Adraras. Welcome to Ouzo Talk.
Welcome.
Nice to be here with you guys. Yeah, I mean, you read the bio. It sounds very, you know, big words and, you know, fancy stuff there. Yeah.
Well, actually, it is pretty fancy.
Yeah. It's for those who, you know, are not technically involved, you know, in those sort of discipline, you know, it sounds a bit, you know, like a UFO thing, UFO.
Yeah. True. Well, I've got to say as well, for those who can't see Vasily, I mean, you'd be forgiven for thinking that he might be a priest because of your beard.
Okay, yeah.
Is this a conscious choice?
I suppose, in a way, yeah. But I think it's more subconscious.
Right.
You know, subconscious, you know, because I really wanted to become a priest, you know,
sure.
for a long period in my life, but it never materialized. So I suppose that's my reaction, you know, my appearance.
Wow. I tell you what, most of my family, they see my beard and, you know, they start, you know, the questions inevitably start.
Yeah.
Why not?
It's a very Greek thing, yeah.
It is, isn't it? Well, we're very glad to have you with us. Nick, shall we do the honours?
Yes, we shall. Let's have a drink.
Yamas.
Cheers.
Cheers. Welcome, Vasily.
Now, we had a sip of this before we went on air, and this one is courtesy of the Greek Providor as well, isn't it, Nick?
It is. Well done, Greek Providor. They've come with the goods again. I don't think we've tried this one.
We haven't.
Atsikoudia from Crete, and it's by the same company that did the Ouzo that we had a couple of episodes ago.
Yeah, right.
35N, which I just found out stands for the latitude that goes through Crete.
There you go.
So that's why they've named it 35N.
We've learnt something.
So what do you think of that?
It's good stuff.
I really like that.
Yeah.
You know what's interesting about this one? It smells a lot more potent than it goes down. I feel as though this one could be potentially dangerous because you could be sitting there drinking.
Yeah.
You have one too many.
Yeah, we did. We had a big whiff of it. What is this?
Yeah.
But then we had it. Oh, it went down nice.
Let's see how we go towards the end of the episode, you know, how far through the bottle.
Well, there's a hint of Shiraz in it as well. That's probably what it gives it that smell.
Mm.
So, but it's only 38% alcohol, so it's quite light for a Tsikoudia.
Well, I mean, leave it to the Cretans to come up with the with the stronger stuff, but this one's actually really palatable. It's really good.
I like it. And what I like even better, it's actually three mates from Crete that got together. And they created this distillery, 35N.
There you go.
So good on you, boys.
Bravo, Pedia.
Yeah.
Good job.
Well done. Team Creek.
Fantastic. And thank you to the Greek Providor again for providing the drinks for us this season. Very much appreciated. Thank you to Crystal. Amazing work as always.
It is. Fantastic. You're the best.
Okay. Let's get into the meat of it, Vasily. What's your background from Greece?
Look, basically, I was born in Australia.
Mm.
So I'm a Bankstown boy.
Yeah,
well, my parents were here as, you know, migrants of the 60s.
Mm.
They eventually returned to Greece. They made it back and they stayed there. And that's where I grew up with my siblings.
Right.
So I'm Australian born, but not Australian bred.
With an accent.
Yeah, with an accent there.
Australian born, Greek raised.
Yeah, Greek raised. So I've been for a big part of my life growing up in Athens.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I studied, you know.
What area?
Brachami, yeah, which is, you know, Agios Dimitrios. Most people know it as Agios Dimitrios, but the natives know it as Brachami, which is, you know, the Turkish term for the region. So, yeah, I grew up in Athens. I studied there. My first degree is in Orthodox theology.
Mm.
And then I continued my studies in world religions.
Right.
History of religions. I came to Australia. I did Aboriginal studies on religion. And basically my whole life I have been studying religion from different perspectives.
Okay, that's fascinating. You know,
like sociology, philosophy, anthropology, psychology, history. Trying to be as holistic as possible.
Mm. So what is it that drew you to that? Obviously you've got a real affinity for the religious and the spiritual.
Yeah.
Why? What's drawn you to it?
Look, that has been a very big question for me. Mm. I have reached eventually an answer.
Okay.
And I think it has been a kind of vacuum created within me. Because, you know, as I said, I was born in Australia. And when we left, I was 7, 8 years old. It was like an uprooting for me going to Greece at that age. I didn't really understand what was happening to me. That dislocation created a vacuum within me. You can look at this as a psychoanalyst, but basically I was always trying to fill in that vacuum that had been created. Αυτή η τρύπα, δημιουργήθηκε μια μαύρη τρύπα, black hole. Yeah. Anything that has to do with religion is really powerful in many respects. So if you're going to really go for something to fill in a vacuum, you're going most likely to look for something really potent, really strong. And that's why I think I turned to religion. Of course, there have been people, you know, throughout my life, you know, like important figures, religious figures, that really inspired me. Mm. Paradoxically, and I really want to stress this, I have never had negative experiences within the church with people.
Right.
Really?
You might come across, and it's very common, you know, even, you know, I mean, not even, especially for Greeks, you know, that in the church, you know, I had this experience with this papa, the other papa, you know, I never had negative experiences with papadas. I suppose I was lucky and I really came across some very inspiring figures. Mm-hmm. So the need to fill in this black hole within me and the lack of having, you know, really good inspiring people around me led me into religion. And then it's basically the thing itself, you know, when you start learning and exploring, you become more hungry and you want to know more and more and more. And, you know, at the end of the day, religion never ends. Yeah. You know, the God question or the sacred, you know, question is always open.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I sort of have conceptualized that way.
It really is the ultimate question of why, isn't it?
The big question, the $1 million, you know, dollar question.
Do you have any ancestors that were part of the church at all that you could relate to? Was it?
Not really. Yeah, yeah. Wow. My family was normal, average Greek family, not very religious. Conventionally, let's say religious.
Yeah.
We didn't have in the family someone who really was into this kind of stuff. No,
right.
Not really.
And where were your parents from?
My father was from Nafpaktos.
Nafpaktos.
Yeah, and my mother from Patra.
And your grandparents from those regions as well?
How far
back do you go?
Oh, the name Adrachtas goes back to the 15th century.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I've located a nobleman in the court of Paleologos, the emperor, the Byzantine emperor, in the 14th century, end of 14th century, early 15th century in Constantinople.
Wow.
And it seems that those Adrachtades, just before the fall or after the fall of Constantinople, left, as many Greeks did, noblemen did, and they went to Peloponnesus.
Right.
And most likely they went to Laconia.
Mm.
So because Laconia has Adrachtades, and then from there they started, you know, dispersing and, you know, going all over the place. So nowadays they are in Laconia, Messenia, Nafpaktia, and Volos. That name, sort of name, but it goes back to the 14th century.
Wow, amazing. And does it mean anything?
Adrachtas means a person who most likely makes, manufactures, or sells adrachtia. The adrachti is the spinning part of a process where you make wool into string. Yep. So you need this adrachti, this spinning thing. Yeah, so it was very important in those days, you know, the medieval period.
Wow. Yeah.
You've got history, Nick, with priests in your family, don't you?
We do, actually. Mm. Yeah, my great-great-great-grandfather, he was a priest in the Suli village that I keep on talking about.
Mm.
And there was a rumor or a myth or a story that came out of it that he met Cosma. So he met this little short guy walking through the mountains and he wanted to go to the ocean. So he took him down the mountain, down the path, and he took him to the coastline. And the story goes that he put his cloth on the water and then he skidded across the water.
You're talking about Saint Cosmas the Atolos?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was the story. So my great-great-great-grandfather, we're talking, I don't know, probably 1700s, 1800s, around there somewhere.
Yeah. But it's a good link to probably what we're going to talk about, because Cosmas, Saint Cosmas, has been a very, very cardinal figure in the connection between Hellenism and Christianity.
Mm. Really?
Yeah, immense.
Wow.
Perhaps, you know, they wouldn't be speaking Greek, you know, in half of Greece without Cosmas.
Now, this is the individual that we were talking about the other episode with Panayoti, who was famed for saying to build schools, wasn't
yeah.
it? Yeah. This is
he built around probably 200 schools, you know, in less than 20 years.
Yeah.
Imagine.
Unbelievable.
Crazy.
And that's a whole other thing as well. You know, the stories of potential miracles and, you know, things like that. I mean, I think we've probably all heard stories like that, and we've probably each got individual stories to tell as well, which I hope we'll get to during this episode. But it's going to be great. Let's move it on, though. I mean, from a very high level, Vasily, what's Greece's connection to Christianity in the Bible? Are there particular people, regions, or landmarks in Greece that hold significant importance in Christianity, history, or theology going right back to the beginning of Christianity?
Look, that's a big question. I mean, we have to break it down, I suppose.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, can we say, let's talk about the Bible. So we've got the Old Testament and the New Testament.
Yeah.
Maybe just give us a quick rundown, because we know the Bible, it's a Greek word.
Yeah. It's a Vivlos. Vivlos, the Bible.
Ta Vivlia?
Yeah, Vivlos simply means book.
Okay.
The book.
Because I read an article the other day, it was the Bible's named after the word, two words, Ta Vivlia, the books.
Yeah.
Is that any truth to that, or was it just named after the book?
No, it's the book. I mean, if there is a book that, you know, deserves the name of a book, that's the
that
book.
One.
Because that, to be honest, was the first book. Okay. The Christians, something that you might not know, is that they can be called, the Christians, especially the Christians, can be called the people of the book, especially the Christians. We normally have this designation for Jews, Christians, and Muslims, but in a general sense, in a very technical sense, the first people who made the so-called codices, they put together the pages and they
sewed them together
and they made something that looked like our modern book with the Christians.
Wow.
Oh, right.
So in a very technical sense, Christians were the first people of the book. But yeah, it's the book. So the Greek word, you know, is there already. Yeah. But the connection is that...
So we've got the Old Testament and the New Testament. The Old Testament is before Jesus was born.
These are designations Christians use, Old Testament and New Testament. The Old Testament has all, you know, includes all those writings that the Christians, in a way, inherited from the Israelite, the Jewish part of their prehistory. Mm-hmm. Now, the Israelites or Jews afterwards didn't call it, of course, and they don't call it Old Testament. For them, it's, you know, the Tanakh. It's the three parts.
The Torah, isn't it?
The three parts. The Torah, which is the law, the prophets, and the sophiological wisdom literature. Some, you know, let's call it very educational sort of stuff around, you know, living properly and blah, blah.
The Old Testament in Greek, we would designate that as being the Septuagint.
The Septuagint is a translation. The Greek translation of the law and the prophets.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so in the 3rd century, the Jews of Egypt, especially Alexandria, were already, let's say, alienated from their linguistic background. They didn't understand Hebrew.
Right.
So they embarked on, you know, a translation of their scriptures for liturgical use so they could understand, you know, the new generations could understand the scriptures. So it's the Jews themselves of Alexandria that translate their own scriptures, basically the law and the prophets, into Greek, which is the lingua franca, the international language at the time.
So that's
the first, let's say, connection. But there are other connections as well. For instance, there is a mentioning of the Greek Empire, the empire of the Macedonians, you know, the Alexander's empire within the book of Daniel, Prophet Daniel.
Right. So Alexander the Great's mentioned in the Bible.
Yeah, the empire of Alexander the Great, you know, is mentioned, you know, in the book of Daniel, the prophetic book of Daniel. Mm. It's one of the empires that I mentioned there. We have the Romans, they have the Macedonians, which are the Greek Macedonians, okay? Yeah. Because sometimes we lose perspective of what we're talking about. We have the Persians, the Assyrians. Mm-hmm. So there is a succession of empires which lead in a descending order to the last days. Mm. So within this descending order, the Greeks, the empire of the Greeks, you know, is mentioned there in the person of Alexander.
Mm. Wow. Just want to backtrack just a little bit. Mm. The Old Testament, there was it 37 books?
It's 49.
49.
In the Roman Catholic Church, for instance, it's less. It's 39. The same in the Western Christian churches, you know, Protestant churches, or even the Jewish communities. But for the Orthodox,
yep,
the Old Testament comprises 49 books.
Okay, and how many of those are in the Bible now?
49. They comprise the Old Testament for the Greeks, not only for the Greeks, for all Orthodox.
Okay, so there's a different Bible then.
There is, yeah. There is a different Bible. The Bible is not, you know, the same for everyone. Yeah, okay. For instance, you have 49 books plus 27, the New Testament, which makes them 76. Mm-hmm. But that's for the Orthodox Church. You know, it's 10 less for Roman Catholics or Protestants.
What was there first? Which one was written first? Or which one was put together first?
The Old Testament, you mean?
Well, the first Bible, is there such a thing? Which one was put
No. The Bible comes into, you know, let's say, existence very slowly. It's the problem of what we call the problem of the canon. Mm. You know, what is a Bible or not? There was no need for a canon. Why? The question one should ask is...
So canon is...
Canon is the rule that says that, you know, the Bible has 76 books or 50 books or 40 books. How many books? And which books, you know, are Christians to regard as the Bible, which is inspired, which is good for them, which is blah, blah.
Yeah.
Now, why would such a problem arise? Yeah. It arises only when between Christians... or between the Jews, because the Jews have their own, you know, canon for the Tanakh. So when, you know, you have disagreements, when you say, look, we have this book, and this book says this, so why are you saying that we should believe that way? And then someone asks, stop, just give me a minute, which book did you mention? Oh, it's the Apocalypse, Apocalypse of Miriam. Apocalypse of Miriam. I haven't heard of that.
Yeah.
We don't have that. Where did you come up with that? Oh, I mean, you know, holy, you know, Mary just gave it to the church herself, you know, before dying. Are you for real? How don't we know about it? So
is that true?
No, it's not. Oh, I mean, okay. that's how things, you know, start, you know, becoming very heated and debated. Okay. When you say that you have a book from this apostle or from Virgin Mary, and then the other, or Mary Magdalene, for instance.
Yep.
And then the others come and say, well, we haven't heard of this. Mm. So, come on, let's be serious now. Let's sit down and let's put things, you know, properly, and let's see which books are really genuine, authentic, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And that's how the first canon comes into existence. The first canon for the New Testament appeared in the middle 2nd century AD.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, it's the famous Muratori canon. Due to the, you know...
Because, the Bible was compiled... I mean, it was compiled by committee, really, at the end of the day, wasn't it?
Great question.
There hasn't been a committee that compiled the Bible in the Orthodox Church.
Really?
So in the Orthodox Church, we don't have a committee or a synod that has, you know, really stipulated which books belong to the Bible. We have, though, great fathers and teachers of the Church who have, you know, included these books or have left out other books.
Hmm.
So, gradually...
Who made the call? Who actually said... See, if there's no committee, was it individuals?
Individuals, yeah. For instance, St. Athanasius in the 4th century has...
good name.
Yeah. has perhaps the first most authoritative, let's say, catalogue of the books that comprise the Bible we have today. Sometimes, you know, certain fathers have books that we don't have today, for instance, that they regarded as being in part of the Bible. To give you an example, we have a book called the Epistle of Barnabas. The Greek Cypriot know Barnabas very well. But that epistle, a very important text, eventually was not included into the Bible. So it's something that, you know, sort of materializes, takes shape slowly, gradually, and eventually it's there, you know. Habitually, you know, it develops. In the Western Church, there are synods, you know, that say that these are the texts, these are the books. In the Protestant churches, this became very, very much of an issue because the Protestants have this sort of very cardinal belief, which is sola scriptura, only the Bible, only the scriptures. So if your faith depends so much on only the Bible sort of belief, then the first thing you should do is define the Bible. But you know, the Orthodox Church, scripture is very important, but it hasn't been, let's say, exclusive. It hasn't monopolized the faith. We have tradition as well. The letter writing hasn't, you know, become the only means of God's revelation. We have iconography, we have the liturgy, we have many things in the Orthodox Church.
Yes.
And it was always more holistic. But for the Protestants, you know, in the 15th century, it was the letter, the word, the page, the book. So it was a great need there to define the Bible. Yeah. So many Orthodox have the sort of wrong impression that, for instance, the First Ecumenical Council, you know, declared what is the Bible and which books belong to the Bible. All that Constantine, okay, said the Bible is from now on, the Bible is going to be this. But nothing can be, you know, further than the truth.
Okay.
Right. Interesting.
Very interesting. So you mentioned the Catholics have 10 book less.
Yes.
The Orthodox one was between 200, 300 AD, I think you said. It came into fruition. Was it the same Bible then? Because Catholics and Greeks, Orthodox, were the same religion.
Yes. It was one church.
And was it one Bible at that time?
Yeah. But don't think of the Bible. Don't think of the Bible as it was. It's. We think it now retrospectively. We project what we have nowadays in our hands as a book, as a physical, you know, entity, and we think that it was always like that.
Yeah.
Which was not. I mean. Okay. In 1,000 years ago or 1,500 years ago, what was the Bible? The Bible was what you heard in the church.
Yes.
What the priest was holding in his hands and he was opening and he was reading, you know, from the apostolos or from the gospel or other readings. It's the Bible is the readings you hear in the church. So there's not one physical book, you know, like the one we have today, and it's very accessible to anyone. So that's not there. Simply, it's not there. Okay. What is there is a sort of reference, a point of reference, a symbolic point of reference, which is the scriptures in a very general sense. Now, the scriptures could be, you know, these or those. They could be 40 or they could be 42. It depends where the church, which church you're talking to. Are you talking about the North African church? Are you talking about the church in Gaul or the church in Italy or the church, you know, in Greece or in Anatolia? Which church are you referring to? So there was a difference, and it didn't really matter. It didn't really matter. It started to become a real big issue when you would raise a question of faith and invoke a certain text. So when you say, for instance, I'll just give an example, that Christ cannot be God because in this book it says that he's the first of the creatures, the created, you know, beings.
So this was the argument at the Council of Nicaea.
Yeah. But then you see, okay, which book is this? Which book is this?
That is after.
Which book?
Yes,
okay, which book is this? Where did you come up with this? Mm. When you, for instance, when you mention the pre-existence of souls, and you come up with books, and there are Christian books, you know, that talk about the pre-existence of souls.
Yep.
You know, we have the Gnostic, so-called Gnostic literature, you know, and then the question is, are these books authentic? Who wrote them? Mm. How are you in hold of them? Why don't we have them? How did they come to you? So the questions of the day and the debates and the need for unity, especially within an empire, to a great extent shaped what we know as the Bible. That's why many fathers said, for instance, look, the fact that we haven't got certain books in the Bible doesn't mean that those books are bad necessarily. For instance, I'll give you an example. In our churches, our Orthodox churches, we have lots of iconography about the life of Virgin Mary. Now, where does that come from? Because our information from the Gospels and the New Testament is minimal. So we know that it comes from the Protevangelion of Iakovu, of Jacob. Mm. A very, very specific apocryphon.
Right.
It's from the Apocrypha literature. But Apocrypha doesn't mean, you know, something, you know, obscure, something, you know, of the occult, something. You don't imagine something like that. It's just something that isn't well known. It's known to some, but not generally in the church. Now, the Protevangelio of Iakovu, speaking about, you know, the parents of Virgin Mary, the early life of Virgin Mary, basically her whole life till her death, has nothing, you know, bad in it. It's a very nice book. A bit fancy at some points, but yeah, I mean, it's not, hasn't got something heretical. That's why it inspired iconographers, and in a way, the church incorporated the book via art on the wall of the of this or that church, on the frescoes.
So would it be fair to say that it, to some degree, those apocryphal gospels or whatever you want to call it is, you know, are providing context around what the canon is?
They are a witness to a broader tradition.
Right.
There are lots of those books which are books which have, you know, the ideas not just beyond the fanciful. They go into, you know, something anti-Christian. They are preposterous.
Which would be heretic.
Yeah, heretic. But others are not. Ambiguous, neutral, or even, you know, they could be described as edifying. Mm. For instance, I have studied especially one of those books, the so-called Gospel of Thomas.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a sayings gospel. A gospel that includes only sayings. That is apophthegmata. Like, for instance, I mean, the end of the world will come when... It might be, you know, trendy as well. The end of the world will come when men become women and women become men.
Well, this is topical.
That up, or was that in there?
No, that's in there.
That's in the book.
That's in the Gospel of Thomas.
Well, there you go.
So it's happening now.
No, no, no. I mean, what the real meaning of this saying is that when, you know, men and women become the same in spiritual terms, you know, when they become equals, when they behave, you know, and when we expect from them the same things and not regard the one better or the one, you know. So when they are interchangeable and there's no difference, then that's the end of the world. Now, the end of the world in Thomas is not some sort of apocalyptic end, destruction. It has different meaning. It's the consummation of the world. That's the good part of the world. So it's what is the saying? Saying it's saying that the world is going to be perfect when women and men are the same.
Equality.
Okay.
But, you know, it can be twisted, for instance.
Yeah, of course.
When you hear it nowadays, you can imagine, you know, heaps of things.
And I suspect as well that the way that it's been translated from the original language would have a great deal to do with
how it's absolutely
interpreted.
But why did I mention that book, that Gospel of Thomas? Because with the, you know,
it's probably the most cited one that isn't.
It's quite, you know, well known nowadays. Apart from two or three passages, which are sort of ambiguous or vague, the rest of it, any Christian can read and really, you know, gain from it, you know, benefit from it. Mm-hmm. There's no reason why they shouldn't.
Okay. I guess a lot of these texts, people can misinterpret that as well.
Oh, yeah. Of course. I mean, if you read, for instance, you remember some years ago the Gospel according to Judas. Judas' Gospel, basically a small passage. There's lots of such Gospels that were going around and they were propagating and promoting certain ideologies or certain practices. So that's why the fathers of the church said, you know, it's better, you know, to play it safe. But of course, you always have to have in mind certain things, you know. Today we are talking about, what, 90-95% of literacy. People going to school, you know, having education proper. You know, 1,500 years ago or more, the levels of literacy or the levels of education were, you know, quite low. We're talking about, you know, max 20%. which, you know, creates lots of problems. Are you equipped? Do you have some sort of background in order to understand properly a text? I mean, you haven't even gone to school.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to read it because you don't know how to read it. But if you hear it from some other person reading it, then you might be, you know, sort of imagining things.
Yeah,
it's quite complicated. It's quite complicated. And we tend to lose context. We think of the Bible, to return to your question, as if the Bible 1,000 years ago was what we call the Bible today. It's a different experience. A different experience. Nowadays, what's the Bible? A Bible is a book you buy from a bookstore, you know, for $50. You can go home, open, and, you know, read it all in, let's say, 1 week. You know, and then study it throughout your life. That sort of experience was simply out of the question 1,000 years ago. Okay? I was talking to my students, you know, last week, because I'm the convener of Greek studies at UNSW, and we do Greek. And I was talking about them, you know, about the Bible, because it's the first book, and it's a book in Greek. And I was telling them that, you know, in order to buy a Bible in those days, a proper Bible, okay, let's say the whole Bible, you most likely would have to sell your house in Vaucluse. The price of the Bible, of a Bible like Old Testament and New Testament, the whole thing would be the price of a house in Vaucluse. Because you would need some, you know, several hundreds of sheep being slaughtered, so you get the skin and then, you know, turn the skin into pages and then have the illustrators and the writers.
Yeah.
I mean, that was massive, you know, enterprise.
Yeah.
Who could do that? No one.
Yeah. So a couple of things. So it was written in Greek.
Yep.
Second thing, were there any Greek Orthodox or any Greeks that wrote chapters or books in the Bible?
So the Old Testament was translated into Greek. Some parts of it, some parts of the Old Testament were written, small parts, originally in Greek. Now, the entire New Testament is written in Greek. Those 27 books are written into Greek.
Okay. So all of them.
All of them, all of them. The first language of, let's say, we could use the term international, ecumenical, global Christianity was Greek.
Okay.
Wow.
So those 27 books, obviously we know who wrote them.
Yes, we know. We know.
Well, you know who.
Yeah. We know. They have come down to us with certain under certain names. Now,
do we know if any of them were Greek?
None of them was Greek.
Okay.
None of them. But some had Greek names.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So were they all Jewish that wrote them?
Now, Jews is a bit, you know, again, you see, it's a bit misleading.
Very generic term.
It's a bit misleading. For instance, the disciples of Jesus, most of the disciples of Jesus were Galileans. Now, if you would say to a Galilean from Galilee that you are a Jew, he would kill you.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Are you serious? I'm a Jew. I'm a Galilean. I'm not a Jew. Okay. I'm a son of Israel. I'm an Israelite. They wouldn't say I'm a Jew.
Yeah. Okay. I thought that's Jew, for instance, Israel was the same thing.
No. The Jew is something, the Jew is an emerging category, you know, from the late first millennium BCE and, you know, in the Christian era. So that's why, for instance, the gospel, especially, for instance, the Gospel of John, according to John, you have, you know, this sort of, you know, negative wording against the Jews. And you wonder, isn't the person writing that a Jew? How is he talking like that against the Jews? But if you don't get the internal dialectics here and the tensions, you won't get it. You know, it's like some Greeks saying that we are more Greeks than you. And so the Jews, which is the Israelites of Judea, were saying to all other Jews, which is Israelites all over what we nowadays know as Palestine, you know, or nowadays Israel, you are not really Israelites. We are the Jews. So the Jew emerged as an sort of attempt to be an exclusive bearer of Jewish identity. So Matthew, Mark, John, Luke are not technically speaking Jews. Okay.
So the Galileans from Israel.
Some are Galileans, some are not. Luke, for instance, belongs to what we call the diaspora, the Hellenic diaspora, Hellenic Judaism.
Right.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that's why he has the most beautiful Greek, the Gospel of Luke. The others were from that region. Ioannis, the Gospel of John, Ioannis, is a Galilean. Now, we have two disciples of Jesus, Andrew and Philip. Yeah. They have Greek names. So amongst the 12, we have two disciples who have Greek names. We don't know them by any other names. Mm. So why am I saying this? Because it shows how much the Greek influence, language, culture had infiltrated and already in the first century influenced what we call Judaism in very broad terms. So there's lots of Greek already, you know, in the Old Testament and of course in the origins of Christianity.
Yeah.
Simply put, you cannot understand the origins of Christianity without Greek.
Yes.
Without Greek, it's impossible. Mm. That's why you have all these, you know, Protestants, especially Protestants in nowadays, going, you know, to college or university to study Greek, to learn Greek, in order to read the Bible in the original language.
Yeah.
Or to understand the context, the historical context.
I just want to take it back real quick to the Old Testament.
Mm.
Are there any other instances where Greeks or, you know, any of those sort of city-states are mentioned in the Old Testament? I mean, I was of the understanding that the Philistines, for example, may have been, that are mentioned in Judges, I think it is, with Samson and whatnot.
It's a theory. It's a theory,
That they were effectively the Minoan civilization.
The people of the sea.
Mm.
It's a theory.
Right.
You know, it hasn't been proved. I don't know if it can be proved. Mm. Probably not, but it could be true. Mm. It could be true. Yeah, we do have the presence of Hellenism in a much more, let's say, important way in the Bible.
Right.
Not the mentioning, you know, of Alexander and the Macedonian dynasty. Not the actual translation of the books. But there are ideas, Greek ideas, philosophical ideas that, you know, find a way into the Bible.
Mm.
For instance, in the so-called wisdom literature I mentioned before, the wisdom of Solomon, for instance, the way wisdom is conceptualized, you know, as the means through which God created the universe, this understanding is very, very Hellenic, especially Stoic. It's the Logos, the cosmic Logos. Mm. So we have, around the 3rd century BCE, a very strong, you know, influence, impact now of Greek thinking into the Bible.
Mm.
Of course, we had, you know, such influence from other sources, you know, earlier, for instance, from Persia or Sumeria into the Bible. This doesn't mean that the Bible is sort of a cocktail.
Mm.
No, it's influences that, you know, the writers themselves, in a way, take on. They work them through, they elaborate on them, and they make them their own.
Mm.
But that doesn't negate, you know, the fact that, you know, there is an influence there. So, yeah, we could even say that as a much more important, fundamental sort of, you know, background of Greek influence in the Bible.
It's interesting you mentioned those influences because, you know, on face value, it seems somewhat unlikely when you consider what ancient Greece is very well known for, whether it's the philosophies or, you know, the democracy and all that sort of thing, that Greece would then adopt this religion that effectively came from the Middle East, from these tribes.
So you're saying, how did that happen?
How did that happen?
And why?
Exactly, because, you know, when the ancient Greeks and the Athenians and, you know, all of these people have this civilization all of a sudden that predates Christianity, how compelling must it have been that they took it on in such a way?
Yeah, so basically you're asking the question, how did the one H, the Hebrew, something coming out of the Hebrew thing, encounter the other H, the Hellenic?
Yes.
And those two H's became, you know...
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah, became two.
Yeah, really.
That's that encounter, that sort of, let's call it, clash and mixing and syncresis. That's the biggest thing that has happened in human history, to be honest.
Really?
It is. The last 2,000 years basically shaped and are still being shaped by those two H's coming together. So why did that happen? I mean, it's a very hard question. There's no one answer, you know, in scholarship, if there is even an answer. My way of, you know, thinking of it and conceptualizing it is that Hellenism, through philosophy basically, because the most important part in Hellenism, the most, let's say, powerful, significant in terms of dynamics, part of Hellenism's philosophy. Mm. Now, that aspect of Hellenism was basically not to articulate an answer about this or that, how did the universe begin, what is this made of, or what is the good, or what is the beautiful, what is being just. It was about that, yes. But more importantly, it was keeping always the question open. In this sense, it seems that Hellenic philosophy, in a way, had realized that it was about something that was doomed, that couldn't really be answered. So it was really like a reaching out. Philosophy is always a reaching out. Imagine it as two hands, you know, stretching out for something they cannot grasp.
Wow.
So what happens? At a certain point, juncture in history, the other H, the Hebrew sort of thing going on its own, you know, for centuries, encounters those two hands. And for a big part of the Hellenic world, the two hands of Hellenism grab and make their own. They embrace what the other H gives as an answer. Not all Hellenes did that, but most of them did it. It took centuries in order to be done. It didn't happen like that. So you have, you know, lots of people saying, you know, that, you know, this Jewish sort of thing came and took over Hellenic world and Hellenic worldview by force. You know, as if Christians, you know, because they are referring to Christians, as Christians, you know, fell from the skies, you know, like Aryans, you know, and took over Greece.
Yeah.
Whereas the truth is that it's the Greeks themselves, the Hellenes, slowly, gradually acknowledging and realizing that what they had been looking for could be given a certain form in this new thing they were coming across. Which is the religion of Jesus, the person of Jesus, the message of Jesus. Was it easy? No. It took lots of time, lots of time in order to come to, let's say, a balance. So you have, you know, great figures like Origen in Alexandria, Egypt, who are the first who really start to tackle the question. Then you have the so-called three hierarchs, Vasilios, Grigorios, Chrysostomos, that put some very, very, very solid foundations. Wow. And then you have many other figures until the, let's say, the middle of the 8th, 9th century, where the whole thing is eventually settled. And then and I'm talking about now the mid of the 8th, 9th century in Byzantium, which is the so-called first Byzantine humanism or Renaissance. And that's when this big enterprise of, you know, Hellenism meeting the Hebrew worldview connected, and they really found a way to move on together.
So how far before that period that you're talking now were the letters to the Philippians, Corinthians,
all those are the 4th century, in the 1st century.
First century.
Yeah, okay. All the letters in the New Testament, most of them are in the first century. There is perhaps one or two or perhaps three texts that can be dated in the first decades of the second century.
So for those who don't know, I'm not sure exactly who, I'm sure that a few of those were written by St. Paul.
Yes.
Not all of them.
14 traditionally are ascribed to Paul.
Right.
Yeah. You have, of course, you know, lots of debate on that. For instance, the Protestants say, most of the Protestants say, that out of those 14, only 7 are really Paul's letters.
Sure.
The others are not. They are from either disciples of Paul or from people that are inspired by the thoughts of Paul. Mm. But
who was he speaking to, really? Like, was
the churches. The churches. Those are the churches in what we call nowadays Greece. So the next connection with Greece, Christianity in Greece, is that the first churches in Europe are Greek or Greek churches. You know, the Thessalonians, yes. Thessaloniki, Philippi.
Corinthians.
The Corinthians. Athens, where Paul moves in Athens and he really makes small congregations, and those are the beginnings of the first churches in Europe.
Okay. What about first churches in the world? Were they in and around Israel?
Those are in what we call nowadays, we used to call Palestine, nowadays Israel. Yeah.
Okay. And then the second lot are in all through Greece.
not only in Greece, but they're also, you know, in Antioch, in Rome, in other places, for instance, Alexandria.
Okay.
But yeah, Paul, wow. Paul is the first, and we're talking about around 50 AD, like 20
this
years,
is very
20
early.
Years after Jesus, you know, 20 years after Jesus, we have the first churches in Greece.
Fantastic.
Wow.
We have churches before that.
Yeah.
Already, you know, in Galilee, for instance.
Yeah.
Or Judea, or in Syria, or Egypt. I would dare say, not only, of course, Asia Minor, but also as west as Rome.
Okay.
Yeah, already. How? Most likely by trade and sure. ship.
Okay, but the first ones you reckon were in Greece? First ones in Europe or Greek?
The first ones are in Judea and Galilee.
Okay, yeah. And then after that, first in Europe?
First in Europe, Christianity was in as Greece. A church, organized church, starts in Greece. We have this information that there were Christians in Rome. For instance, Paul, when he gets to Corinth, he comes to meet a couple, a very famous couple in the New Testament, Aquilas and Priscilla. Yep. And they come from Rome, and they are already Christians.
Wow.
So this means that Christianity had reached Rome before Paul coming to Greece. But we don't have evidence, solid historical evidence, that there was an organized church there. Perhaps there were some Christians, you know, that found, you know, let's say the fortunes of life had led them there.
Yeah.
So we don't have solid historical evidence that there were organized churches before 50 in Rome, for instance. But we do have, you know, for Greece.
Mm.
The church in Thessaloniki was established in 50 or 51.
Wow.
So is it fair to say that Paul was the first to preach to Greece, or was that someone else? Did that
no,
happen?
Paul is the first. Hmm. Paul is the first, but he was not the only. After him, others came as well. They were claiming some other emphasis, I would say, on the gospel. They would create lots of problems. Others would be, you know, more of a Peter sort of Christianity. Others are Paul Christianity. Others are Apollo. Another person, you know, a Christianity. So you see, there were also, you know, power relationships and, you know, and clashes within Christianity itself, like any religion.
Yeah.
And fierce, you know, sort of clashes. You know, it's famous, or perhaps infamous, the clash between Paul and Peter in Antioch.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah.
What was that about?
It was about, you know, the prerequisites of being a proper Christian. Mm. The first Christians were Israelites.
Mm-hmm. Mm?
Galileans, Judeans, whatever. Those people had circumcision. Very important for them. It was an identity marker, even Jesus had. So they were saying, if you want to be a Christian, you have to, you know,
be circumcised.
Yeah, circumcised. Now, Paul was the first, adamantly, very, very, you know, emphatically saying that this is not going to happen. It's only faith in Jesus. You don't need to be, you know, circumcised. Peter had accepted himself people from the ethnic, you know, Gentiles, without circumcribing. But when he went to Antioch, because there was a real, let's say, strong group of Judeans there, Lufaxe.
What?
Yeah, Lufaxo Petros. He said, okay, here, we have all this, you know, this is a camp here, yeah. This is, you know, imagine. But Paul, when he went there, he said to him, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
Are you afraid of these people here? Because, you know, they are majority and they might, you know, shut you out from, for instance, any of their, you know, sort of business or company. Haven't we decided, you know, that you are a Christian through faith?
Wow.
Okay.
And where is Antioch? Where is that?
That's in Syria. That's north, north of it's north of now of modern Lebanon.
Okay. Yeah. Wow.
I mean,
northeast.
Okay.
You raise a very interesting question, though, and it's a question that many of us have asked. You know, during the course of being Christian, if Jesus was a Jew, and our faith and, you know, is rooted so much in that faith, the question is always, why aren't we Jewish first? Why are we not deemed to be?
Yeah, that's
that
a
first?
Big question, you know. Yeah, because technically speaking and academically speaking, if we want to be, you know, really, really accurate, in a way we would say that Jesus was not a Jew. Of course, we have this famous, you know, dictum that Jesus was a Jew. Mm. But, I mean, a very famous theologian, Wellhausen, said Jesus is a Jew. But a Jew was a very specific Israelite in the first century. It was one that was monopolizing the Israel identity and making it equivalent to certain things, like, for instance, adherence to the law, adherence to the temple and its rituals, purity, blah, blah. Now, in many respects, Jesus was against these things. And by the end of the day, he was regarded as a Galilean. Even the Jews, you know, of the day, not what we call Jews nowadays.
Yeah.
We should not work in what we call historical projectionism, because it's wrong historically.
Yeah.
What was called a Jew then, or what was emerging as a Jew, that sort of people called Jesus a Galilean.
Right.
Can anything good come out of Nazareth? A Galilean? Is the Messiah, you know, coming from Galilee?
Yeah.
Come on.
This Galilean, you know? Carpenter.
Yeah. I mean, it's... But in some other cases, though, we could say that if there is one Jew ever in human history, that's Jesus. Mm. Jesus is the Jew.
Yeah.
But Jesus identifies himself. The only thing that he does, he neither says, I'm a Galilean, or he says, I'm a Jew. He only identifies himself with Israel.
Wow. Mm. What was Judas then?
Judas?
Yeah.
We're not quite sure. Judas might have been, you know, a member of a fraction of a revolutionary sort of group. Most likely he was a Galilean. Okay. But he could have been a Judean as well, because it seems that he has some connections. From the Gospels, we understand that Judas has some connections with the Judean establishment in Jerusalem.
Right.
He moves easily within those circles.
Yeah.
Perhaps due to his educational connections. We're not quite sure. But Judas Iscariotis, Sicarius, was one with a knife.
Okay.
Right. Okay.
You know?
Yeah. Wow. So Jesus, he spoke Greek. Is that correct?
Jesus spoke
Aramaic. That was his primary language?
That was the language he would use, you know, in everyday situations, Aramaic. But he knew Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
He would go into the synagogue, you know, into the place of worship and read from the scriptures, which is Hebrew. And as far as I can say, you know, as a scholar, and I think most scholars agree, he would use Greek. He would use some Greek. You know, people knew Greek.
Would he have written
Spasta Pulemia, Spasta Elinika. Everyone knew in Israel, Palestine, okay, those days.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most likely he would knew. You know, he would know Greek. So now,
to communicate,
how much of Greek he used? Mm. Some say that the discussion between him and Pontius Pilate took place in Greek.
Yes,
perhaps. Although I don't think it's really necessary.
Mm. Did he ever leave Israel? Did he end up at Greece at any time, Jesus?
No, never.
Never.
And never, he never went to India as well. Or Tibet, you know? No.
He didn't go there after his death?
No. Probably.
Well, there's been...
All over the place after his death.
I mean, there are so many documentaries on, like, National Geographic that speculates about these things.
And
Where they say, for example, like, this is... Where was it? Shangri-La or something like that. This is where he's buried and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Like, but as historians, we rely on witnesses, historical witnesses.
Yeah.
Now, we know that Jesus, you know, moved much of his active ministry outside of the limits of Palestine. That's very interesting. For instance, when he meets the Canaanite woman, he's already in what we would say, we call nowadays Lebanon. Why does he move, especially in out of Galilee, in the northern parts, out of Galilee? That's an interesting question. He moves out of the limits of Galilee, which is out of the limits of Palestine. Or why does he move, you know, eastwards of Jordan? He selectively moves within Galilee or Judea. He is very careful, you know, where he moves around. Now, the most likely answer is that it might sound a bit, you know, provocative, but that's the real answer. He didn't want to be caught.
Mm.
He was sought after, you know. So imagine a person, you know, really creating a kerfuffle. The first thing you want, if you are, you know, like a person in authority, get rid of him.
Yeah. Mm.
So what do? You mean you hit and you run. You hit and you run. So you are there. Okay. You make a big sort of thing, you know, a real kerfuffle, and then you disappear. And you move out of the jurisdiction of the authority.
Great. So he makes sense.
He hits in a literal but also metaphorical sense.
Spreads Christianity.
Yeah,
and then
he hits with his message. Yeah. He creates, you know, a sort of spiritual awakening and uprising, and then he moves away.
Yeah, okay.
And he does that many times. Mm. But when he knows that the time has come, then head on, he goes to Jerusalem. And that's the last week of his life. He stops hitting and moving around. We are overplaying.
Mm.
And he goes straight ahead to Jerusalem.
Mm.
That's the only, wow. In the last week of his day, that's the only time we see Jesus going consciously, programmatically to Jerusalem, knowing what's going to happen.
Mm.
He doesn't play around anymore. The critical mass regarding the reaction from the populace is already there.
Mm.
We have done what we needed to do, you know, to create a following.
Mm.
Now we go there. Of course, Jesus knows that, you know, if he goes there with all these, you know, people following him,
mm.
the people are going to pay severely the cost. So what does he do? He gives his life instead of them. He manages that so that all this following is spared, and he's the one that pays the price.
Yeah.
Now, this, of course, is one level. This has multiple spiritual levels in theology. But the most basic, you know, surface level is that all these people going with him, and we know from the entrance, you know, Kyriaki
Ton Vaion,
all these people going together with him are going to be slaughtered by the Romans if he doesn't do anything. Because they want him Messiah. You know, they want him, you know, enthroned in Jerusalem. They're going to slaughter them, all of them.
Mm. Yeah.
So the only way out is that Jesus gives his life for them instead of theirs. So that's the most basic core sort of point of reference when we think of the theology of sacrifice.
Mm.
It's interesting that you know the way that you characterize that last week of his life as well, because when you think of the way that he enters the city, I mean, this is not someone who's looking to lay low, you know.
No, at all.
Right? Entrance into the city, massive public reception, followed by overturning tables in the temple.
Yeah.
Like, these are not the signs of someone who is laying low anymore.
No.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of it that way before.
Yeah. He's creating consciously.
It's almost like he's daring them
to some degree. Yeah.
I'd never thought of it that way before.
And the only way out is that he offers his life so that everyone...
Spare everyone else.
Everyone is spared.
Very interesting.
And he got crucified, obviously. Was that a common way to kill people back then? Crucifixion?
For certain crimes, yeah. For instance, treason.
The Romans were very good at
treason,
it.
Treason, of course.
It was like a slow torture, like a slow
death.
Yeah, slow death. And he lasted, what, 3 days on the cross?
No, 3 hours.
Oh, 3 hours.
3 hours,
which is very quick.
Yeah, very quick. 3 hours. Nine from Apoora Enatiseos, Apoora Tritiseos Ectis, which is, you know, 3 hours.
So what time was it from 3 to 6?
Yeah, I think, if I'm correct here, from 9 to 12 or from 12 to 9, it's 3 hours.
So in the morning,
12 to 3,
before lunch.
I think perhaps it's 12 to 3.
And he got stabbed by a Roman soldier
afterwards. Pierced.
Just to make sure
There's not so much. All of this is not perhaps. It's not related to Hellenism, but
yeah, of course.
Yeah. But it's interesting.
It just came, you know.
No, this is very interesting stuff.
No, it is.
Yeah.
Wow.
Very good. Well, look, let's go back to the Hellenism.
Yeah.
You know, side of things. I mean,
so he didn't know. He didn't ever read Homer or Plato, and he didn't, you know, engage, you know, in comedy or, you know, that tragedy. Okay.
And he wasn't Greek.
Yeah.
Okay. Tick. All right. But his 12 apostles were definitely all Jewish.
Well,
that we know.
Galilean.
Sorry. Yep,
Galilean, Judean.
Yep,
yeah.
I did
whatever.
Listen. Galilean.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
Thanks, Tom.
Israelites.
And then after that, the 12? Was it the 76?
The 70. The 70. Yeah, a broader group.
With any of them Greek?
There seem to be lots who belong to what in those days they would call Hellenes.
Okay.
But meaning what? Meaning...
So when I say Greek, I mean Hellenes. Hellenes.
Hellenes, yes.
It's the same thing, isn't it?
Yes, but yeah. In those days, you could be called a Hellene without... That didn't mean that you were from Greece, what okay. we call nowadays Greece. Mm. It means that you were a bearer of a certain culture, you spoke a certain language, you had a certain consciousness.
Wow.
So okay. the Jews, or the Israelites, better,
yeah.
of the diaspora, who spoke Greek, thought like Greeks, you know, they were called Hellenes, Hellenes. So
go.
A big question is, when the Hellenes come to one of the apostles, and the apostle leads them to Andrew, and Andrew leads them to, says Jesus, look, Lord, I mean, we have these Greeks, they have come to see you. And he says there, now it's the time for the Son of Man to be glorified. Now, who are those Greeks? Who are those Hellenes? Are they from Patra, Athena? Or are they Israelites from the diaspora mm-hmm. who would have gone, you know, to Jerusalem for the Passover?
Mm.
But they were regarded as aliens. In the book of Acts, we have the first clash between, you know, we're talking now two years after Jesus.
Yeah.
The first clash in the community in Jerusalem is between the Ιουδαίοι and the Ελληνιστές. Οι Εβραίοι και οι Ελληνιστές. Εβραίοι και οι Ελληνιστές. Who are those Ελληνιστές? They are, you know, the Hellenizers. Those who, you know, were part of the Hellenic culture. So Israelites, ethnically, but not culturally and linguistically or whatever. Mm-hmm. Again, you have the Hellenic, you know, permeating as a cultural, as a linguistic feature.
How long have they been there? Were they part of Alexander the
Great? With Alexander the Great and the empire he established, Hellenism becomes more and more and more part of the entire Middle East.
Because all that area got Hellenized, what was it, 300 BC?
Yeah, yeah, 3rd century.
Yeah, and Cleopatra was there till, what, 90 BC or something like that?
Yeah, yeah, it? Cleopatra, yeah, was there in Egypt.
Yeah.
So
it's filling up.
Yeah, Yamas. Yamas.
Jeez, man, this is good. Good chat, fantastic. Boys. I love all this stuff.
This is the best conversation we've had on this.
Okay.
Finally. So we can tick some boxes now.
Absolutely.
So when we talk about Hellenism, we should, all those listening, should just disassociate from the ethnic understanding. You know, in those days, a Hellene is someone who speaks Greek, who behaves and thinks like a Greek.
But they weren't physically necessarily born in Greece.
No.
Got it. No. But someone born in Greece was an Hellenes.
Someone born in Greece might call himself an Hellenes as well, you know, but they were not more Hellenes than others.
But what you said, there was a difference. The Hellenes and the...
The Evrei. Those are Jerusalem. We have Christians who are from they are Evrei.
Yeah.
They are Hebrews, you know. And then we have Christians that are Hellenes, which are Israelites from the diaspora, talking Greek and, you know, behaving like Greeks. And for some reason, they found their way to Jerusalem and they stayed there because they became part of the first church.
Yeah.
But because they think differently, the Greek mindset and the Hellenic and the Hebrew, for the first time, clash because they think differently.
Yeah, true.
Okay.
So, all right, so then we've got the 70 apostles. Some of those may have been...
I think most of them were part of the diaspora, the Israelite diaspora.
Okay.
Yeah. Even if you see their names, traditionally their names, Aristarchos.
Okay,
that's very Greek, right?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Classic.
Mark, for instance. Mark is regarded as one of them, and he's regarded as Marcos Ioannis.
Pretty Greek.
Yeah, Ioannis is not Greek.
Isn't it?
Yeah, but Marcos is Roman. That being said, the Greco-Roman feature here.
So what's Ioannis then? Is that...
Yohanan. Right. It's the most Greek names are not Greek.
Yeah.
Ioannis is not Greek. Maria, half of the population doesn't have a Greek name.
Yeah.
I mean,
so
it has
Maria
been,
is Galilean.
Miriam. Miriam. Yeah, it's an Israelite name. It's a Hebrew name.
Yeah.
I mean, they have been Hellenized. In the sense that we know them, Maria,
yeah.
Okay, Ioannis, or Iakovos.
What about Nick? Is that Greek?
Nikolaos is Greek.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Just checking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very
what
Greek.
What about my name, mate? Yeah. Mine's definitely Christian.
Anastasios?
Anastasios. Yes. No, it's not. It's Christian, but it's Greek.
Yes,
there you go. So, right. I didn't know. Jan, I know a few Johns out there.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're not Greek.
Yeah. Sorry, boys. Hand in your Greek pass.
So you see how it, how those two H's created a new thing.
Yeah. I can't help but think that that's just thrown me off the two H's.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Has a book been written by that title?
No, it hasn't.
You should write it.
Yeah, yeah. The two H's. Yeah.
Man, that is absolutely brilliant. Oh, that's a podcast in itself.
That's brought on a whole new perspective for me personally.
Yeah, me too.
Honestly.
Definitely. And the way you just described it as well. Should we talk about who was the guy at Revelation?
Ioannis.
Yes. We were just talking about Ioannis.
Ioannis.
Saint John, Ioannis.
Yeah, yeah.
So he wrote the Revelation in the cave in Kos.
No, Patmos.
Oh, Patmos. Yes.
Patmos, yes.
And I've been there, yes.
Yeah, Patmos. One of the, let's say, most important pilgrimages in Greece.
Yes.
Yeah, Patmos. The monastery there is from, if I'm correct, from the 11th century.
Wow.
It's a communion monastery.
Because the cave is still there. They've got the monastery above it.
Well, just on that point, there's a very interesting parallel between the story of him writing that book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just making the connection. I haven't read up on it or anything. I may be completely wrong. But there seems to me to be an interesting parallel between how he wrote the book of Revelations and how Muhammad is said to have written or been dictated to the Quran. Is there any connection between the two from a scholarly perspective?
There is a connection. There is a similarity in terms of, that both texts are regarded as God-inspired.
Mm. Or dictated, let's
yeah,
say.
Or in the case of Muhammad, it's the actual words. Mm. Jibril, which is, Gabriel, says the words, the actual words. That's why, in Islam, when it comes to the Quran, the words are not to be tempered with.
Mm.
Don't touch the words. That's the words that came out of the mouth of Archangel Jibril. Mm. Now, in the case of course, God-inspired books in the Bible and, for instance, the Revelation, the inspiration is regarded in a more general sense as, God in a way guiding or illuminating the intellect of a person.
Yes.
And in a way facilitating the certain ideas which are related to his own experiences. That's why the books never cease to have, the features of one's personality.
Mm. Interesting. For those who maybe don't know the story, tell us briefly what the story of John writing the book of Revelation.
The Revelation is a book that belongs to a certain genre, which is called revelatory literature. Mm-hmm. And in this type of literature, you have Jesus or perhaps Virgin Mary or an angel revealing to a group of people or to an individual certain answers for instance, to questions or what is going to happen in the future, or giving specific guidelines in order to behave in this or that way. In the case of the Revelation of John, we have Jesus himself revealing to John, his disciple, what is going to happen in the end of days. So that's the end of history, the end of time. Now, time and the end of time for God is quite different from what it is for us. I mean, we think of the end of something as something very, very specific. If something has a time span of, let's say, 100 years, the end of it would be the last year or the last 2-3 years. Now, those 2-3 years for God might be three millennia. God is not subject to,
outside the time.
Yeah, the understanding of we have about time. So in Christian theology, when we talk about the end times, we talk about the time starting with Jesus. So with Jesus and after Jesus, all the period is regarded as end times.
Right.
So the revelation that Jesus gives to John relates to the period that he inaugurated. It's not about a period that, is going to start sometime in the future. It's already started. And it's going to repeat itself in the same manner. So what you see there in terms of this or that plague, is an aspect that is to be repeated, because we live in the same condition. We haven't changed. Perhaps the book is against, you know, the emperor of Rome, and it is. Rome is the Babylon.
Yes.
The great whore, as it is called. It's a very, very provocative book. Mm. In some sense, I would call it anarchist.
Yeah.
It's very revolutionary. It's against authority. It's against the empire. It's against the condition of human living as we know it in history, for the sake of something different.
It's a very different book. Yeah, it's a very
militant sometimes book. Mm. Now, being against the Roman Empire doesn't mean that, you know, it's only against the Roman Empire. It can be against any empire. Mm. It can be against any state that, you know, absolutizes itself, because the condition is the same. Mm. The book had a very, very strange sort of reception. To return to the question we were discussing about the Bible,
yep.
Is it part of the Bible or not? Mm. For many centuries, it wasn't in the Bible.
Mm. Well, stylistically, you could very easily leave it out.
I mean, it's the only book that belongs to the genre of apocalypse, and it's not even read, you know, in the church. Never.
So the Revelation is never read. Wow.
There's no reading, liturgical reading in the Orthodox Church that comes from Revelation.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Because the book is simply, in some senses, very provocative, very, you know, can be very touchy, you know. And the other sense, you know, it's, how do you interpret it? It's, you know, it can be very, you know, difficult and messy sometimes. Mm. But it has been incorporated. For instance, there's lots of churches or lots of monasteries, especially in Mount Athos, that have the Apocalypse depicted as iconography. Mm. So the all not read, it's there.
Yeah.
Present in its absence. The same way the Protevangelion of Iakovos about Virgin Mary.
Yep.
Never in the canon, but in the church. Present in its absence. The only church I know of that has a liturgical use of the Revelation is the Coptic Church. The Coptic Orthodox Church uses the Book of Revelation, especially in the Lent, leading to Pascha. And I think, if I'm not wrong, that it's used in the high Anglican Church, Church of England, during the...
It wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, matrimony.
Oh, really?
Yeah, matrimony.
That's an interesting place for it.
Because it's about, you know, it's about the church, you know, and the union of the church in Christ. And that's a typos, a type, an image of the union between men and women.
I'm trying to recall whether... I went to a Catholic school, went through the whole Catholic system. I can't remember them actually... I'm pretty sure they may have done readings from Revelation in that during the Mass. I'm not sure.
Perhaps, yeah.
Okay. Can we talk about the schism that happened in...
Lots of schisms. Which one? The big one.
The big one.
The great schism.
The schism.
Yeah, 1054.
So that was when the Byzantine Empire sort of split. You got Catholics on the west, Orthodox on the right. Is that...
Yeah, we have this split, which is...
So why did they split first?
It's a development that happened after a prolonged period of lots of developments. So there's lots there in terms of politics, ideological differences, cultural differences. The two parts of the let's call it the empire, were just drifting apart and apart and apart for centuries. When the Christians of the East decided to put into the creed a certain theological understanding, which the Eastern Christians knew about, which is the filioque, that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son. Mm-hmm. Now, they knew about it. The Eastern theologians knew about it, the fathers, you know. And they were sort of, you know, reserved and okay, just keep it as a thing, as a, let's say, a meditation, a reflection. It's okay, you mean something. We haven't got that sort of understanding here. But once it got into the creed and you made it into an article of faith, that, in a way, was a dynamite for all the fuel being there, politically, economically, culturally, difference, to explode. Mm. Because many a time, there's scholars who say that the causes were not religious. That's a tricky thing. Now, there's lots of, you know, let's say, accumulated tension. But that tension is not the cause. That tension is the fuel that simply makes the whole process more powerful. The real cause is the difference in faith, which in a way just makes all the tension explode. So we shouldn't confuse things. I'm just using this image so I make it easier for the people to understand it.
Yeah.
That's the big problem for us. And in many respects, there are Orthodox theologians today who say that if you take out the filioque from the creed, things are going to be very, very easy. Very, very easy.
So what's the creed? The Bible?
The creed.
Nicene Creed.
The Nicene Creed. Nicene and Constantinople. It's the
Pistevo.
It's the two ecumenical councils, the first and the second, who made the Pistevo, which we recite every Sunday in church. So it's the basic declaration of faith.
Yes.
Okay.
So you messed with that. So take it out. If you take it out, then you know there's a way to coexist, because we say we confess the same thing. Now some say that, you know, the basic issue is not that, and that the Roman Catholic Church
just to be clear, they added something into it. So the East Orthodox,
they added this expression filioque in Latin, which means «και εκ του Υιού» in Greek.
Okay.
«Και στο πνεύμα το Άγιον».
Yep.
Έτσι.
So
«το εκ του Πατρός εκπορευόμενον», we say.
Mm-hmm.
They say «το εκ του Πατρός και του Υιού».
Okay.
«Φιλιόκβε».
Okay.
So, take it out. Now, there's lots of people saying that the Roman Catholics don't have a problem taking it out. So most likely they don't.
Yeah, did the Roman
but Catholics? How do you take out the Pope?
Okay.
The real issue, they say, is not the filioque now, but the Pope.
Okay.
The place of the Pope, the way that the Pope functions in the church. You know, it's like you have the church and the Pope. You don't have the Pope in the church, but as if you have the church and the Pope. We in the East, you know, Orthodox Christians, wouldn't have a problem, you know, to have the Pope as the first see, because he was the first see. Constantinople was the second see. The first see in a council. So because, you know, in a council, someone has to, you know, someone has to call the council. You know, how are you going to call? Yeah. Anyone could just say, are we going to have a council? No. That would be, you know, the first. Who's the first?
The Pope.
Then he's the one who has the prerogative to call the council. And he presides. And as a president, you know, he has a certain, you know, some rights that, you know, give him some sort of, you know, advantage as a president.
Yeah.
You know, all this is okay. That happens in every human endeavor that follows, you know, let's say a democratic order. But what happens when you don't have a council and you just have the Pope declaring to all others that something is true or might not be true or could be true or whatever? The issue of papacy, as we call, of the place of the Pope, the authority, the way we understand the authority of the Pope is now the big issue.
Mm.
And I don't know how we can go about or buy this, really. I'm one of those who I'm against the union between Christians.
Right.
Yeah, because we don't need to be, you know, like united. I mean, it's good to have the Roman Catholic Church. It's good to have the Greek Orthodox Church, you know, different churches.
Yeah.
We can be, you know, really, really, you know, respecting and mutually, you know, loving one another and working together. But we don't need to unite, you know, because to be honest, how can you unite when for the last one millennium you belong to a different history?
Yeah.
Mm. Union, true union between, you know, not religions, but simple people, everyday people. I'll give you an example. I came from Greece, you know, after being, you know, raised in Greece, 26 years, and I came to Australia for the first time. Okay, I'm absent from Australia 26 years. People of my age have lived their lives here in those years, have, you know, have a trajectory.
Yeah.
Have, you know, an understanding of the place. I come here and suddenly I find myself a stranger. Mm. I reach out, I try, and everyone else is good to me.
Yeah.
But I cannot connect.
Yeah.
Because people have already...
But even just the other big things, like even our christenings, for example. How traditional are our christenings to what it was, you know, 2,000 years ago?
Well, we do immersion, whereas the Catholics don't. It's more of a
symbolic Catholics thing. Are very modernised. So when we spread oil all over the...
There are lots of differences in that respect, but...
But we're still very traditional, aren't we?
Yes, but we shouldn't, you know, look into, I would dare say, petty things. The tradition is something changing, something alive.
Yeah.
Tradition is something alive. You can, you know, make something out of it new.
Yeah.
Because it's there to cater for the needs.
Yeah.
So it's not a big deal, you know, if you're going to do the baptism that way or that way in terms of watering.
Yeah.
The issue in baptism is in the name of whom do you baptize?
Mm.
Do you baptize in the name of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit?
Yeah.
Mm. Or do you baptize in the name of Jesus? We have, you know, Protestant groups. I baptize you in the name of Jesus. That's not a baptism.
Mm.
Because the formula has been, you know, traditionally,
yeah,
in the name of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit. Now, if it's going to be immersion in a lake, in a river, or in a kolivithra, and, you know, if the water is going to go over all inches of your head or not, that's a petty thing.
Yeah.
I think so.
Sure.
Yeah. So there are lots of such issues, but the big issue is the ecclesiological issue, the issue of authority in the church. What is the church? And here, the question of the Pope is cardinal. Is the Pope under the church or over against the church? Like,
well, to that point, well, right up against that point, really. Does the Catholic Church and the Greek Orthodox Church or the Eastern Orthodox Church, do they regard each other as heretics? Have they both excommunicated each other? Is that still the way they look at each other?
I understand... Tasso, what you're saying, I'm not one of those who like the term heretic.
Mm.
Nowadays, I think that sort of language is obsolete. It did serve a purpose, but I don't think that the situations now are the same.
Mm.
We are different. We belong to different histories. We represent different experiences, but I wouldn't call them heretics.
Mm.
Personally, I wouldn't. But at the same time, I can't see us uniting because we are different. And it's nice, it's wonderful to be different and to be able, you know, to cherish your difference. I think so, even in Christianity.
Well, what is the relationship between the two?
Now there are groups who regard them as not just heretics, but they're arch heretics.
Yes.
There are groups who say that, no, they're not heretics.
Mm.
There are groups, and especially scholars, who say that there's no ecumenical council that has, you know, excommunicated or declared heretics the Roman Catholics, and blah, 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 blah. But, of course, we have a long literature, you know, during the millennium that has, you know, passed, and we have texts that refer to them as heretics, and official texts.
Yes.
Now, I mean, is that tradition? Yes and no. The church is the authority of itself. It's not this or that text that is going to dictate to the church that what it should follow.
Yeah.
Perhaps I should make this clearer. I mean, there might be ecclesiastical documents, official documents, that say a certain thing. Now, 3, 4, 5 centuries afterwards, the church might, you know, say, look, we said that then, but now we say something different.
Yeah.
Mm.
Because it does not pertain to the faith, but to the way we interacted with a problem.
Mm.
And you don't interact in the same way with a problem. You interact differently.
Yeah.
So we call the Roman Catholics, you know, during the Ottoman period, we call them heretics.
Mm.
What does that mean? That we have to call them heretics till the second coming?
Yeah.
No. It's a jargon. It was a rhetoric of the days. It was the way people expressed themselves.
Yeah.
We shouldn't stick to those things because they are not the tradition of the church. And I think it's a quite Greek thing, you know, to be flexible in terms of thinking.
Yeah.
Greeks were always flexible thinkers.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just think back to, I think it was 1998. I remember I was in Greece. It was either 98 or 2000. I'm pretty sure it was 98. And the Pope was visiting Greece.
Yes.
I think it was 2000. I can't remember. I can't remember for the life of me. But I will never forget this woman in Greece waiting for him at the airport, who was dead against him even coming.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think the quote was, could be wrong, the Pope, the Pope is a killer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like there are people with very, very strong views about
this. Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. Very, very strong. And people that, you know, just go bazookas, you know, like like a Pope is the Satan incarnate, you know, like sort of, you know, rubbish. Mm. I remember when the Pope went to, you know, came to Greece, because I was in Greece at the time, and I actually was speaking about, you know, that visit, you know, on TV and radio, you know, being invited for interviews. And it was Christodoulos. Mm. Christodoulos was the Archbishop of the day. And for his, you know, it should be credit to him that he was eventually, he accepted, you know, the visit to take place. Mm. Although we know Christodoulos was quite a strong person in terms of his views.
Yes.
Roman Catholics, brothers are not heretics. Well, by the way, for instance, let's be real, you know, how many Greeks send their children to Roman Catholic schools?
A lot.
Half of the students in Roman Catholic schools, I'm exaggerating now, but it's for a reason. Half of the students are Greeks.
Well, I was one of them.
Yeah, my children are.
Yeah.
So
don't send them for the religion thing. It's just a good school, I'm assuming.
Yes, it is. But I am sending them for the religion as well, because they offer a kind of, I mean, for the religion in broader sense, not for the faith, the Roman Catholic faith, but for, you know, the sense of a perspective in life, of
that's
an
very
ethos,
important.
Of an understanding of a different sort of, you know, stance. Again, in terms of value.
That's what's lacking in the education in Greece.
Yes, because absolutely.
Because when you're in Greece and you talk about these subjects with people, say, of my age, you get the distinct feeling that there are blinkers on. The only thing that exists is us, and there's nothing else
around.
At least that's been my experience.
Yeah, yeah.
The one thing that I will say, for having had a Catholic education growing up, is that it opened that door to say, well, we are one of many. This is my tradition, that's yours, that's fine, but we're not the only ones.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which I think is important.
And the point is that one knows what they are and what they stand for.
Exactly.
And they respect the other. Mm. I used to say that, you know, I'm a very ecumenical Christian, because I'm Greek Orthodox. Mm. My children, you know, go to a Roman Catholic school, and in my car I always listen to Hope. Hope is a Protestant, you know, Pentecostal, evangelical radio station, the most famous in Sydney. So
it's a mix.
It's a mix. It's a mix. Why not? Why am I?
Open thinker.
Yeah,
open,
I mean, why not?
There's something to be learned from it, from everything. Really.
Yeah,
it's,
but I would never, you know, confuse the issues of faith. Faith, that's our faith.
Yeah.
You know?
Very interesting. Mm.
But wouldn't I respect, you know, St. Francis of Assisi? Who wouldn't respect St. Francis of Assisi? Mm. I mean, come on.
I want to ask a general question that's kind of a little bit off topic, but the significance of Hagia Sophia, for those who maybe don't understand, what is the significance of that building and the symbolism of that place?
The two H's together. That's it. That's
it, just keeps coming back to that.
That's the two H's
it?
Together in architectural, artistic terms.
Wow.
You know, you have something very Greek there, but at the same time, so Oriental. The Hellenic and the Hebrew, and via the Hebrew the Eastern part thing, have come together, you know, in Hagia Sophia. Perhaps I'm not the best person to ask about this, because I've never been to Konstantinopoli. Mm. I've never been to Hagia Sophia. So,
I have.
Yeah,
have you been, Nick?
Yeah, I have.
So you have a feeling. You have a real sort of, you know, somatic picture of it.
It's very strange, isn't it? I mean, It was surreal being in that building. And I mean, there were a lot of, this was before it had, you know, it was changed back into a mosque more recently, and it was a museum at the time. But there were so many people in that building in that building at the time, but it was unbelievable.
Yeah, I want to go back, because I went with an Irish backpacker, and he wouldn't shut up. He just kept on. I wanted to actually take it in. I wanted to shut my eyes, get the feel of it, look around the detail. But this guy wouldn't shut up. And there's people everywhere. I go, mate, I just want to take it in. I want to absorb. You know?
Yeah.
So I read a lot about it and stuff. So that's why I want to go back. But I did take it in. And I was amazed how high and open it was.
Yeah.
I can imagine when the Byzantine chanting would start, how beautiful it would have sounded in there.
Well, on that point, I think it was a couple of years ago now, there was a group of
American scholars. They have
audiologists or something like that that went in and ran a test by popping a balloon in the center of the church. They placed microphones around the place, They popped the balloon in the center. They recorded what it sounded like. And from that, they were able to create a filter that you could then apply to something like what we're recording in right now.
Or Byzantine music and listen how it would listen.
Exactly.
How it would
so that sound. So that was the catalyst to create the filter that they then applied to Byzantine chant. And
it's amazing. It's amazing.
This is what it would have sounded like to hear this in Hagia Sophia. It was next level.
Yeah, that would have been
unbelievable
stuff.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant stuff.
Yeah. It's very eerie.
Yeah.
But since we're talking about Hellenism,
we
should note that one of the most Hellenic depictions, in Byzantine art is in Hagia Sophia. The mosaic of the Virgin Mary you see in the church in the Apsida is the most Hellenic mosaic we have from the entire history of Byzantine art.
Wow.
It's basically the Christian appropriation, transformation, and reinvention of the seated female goddess figure of ancient Greece. So you have these statues with the goddesses, you know, sitting or standing.
Yep.
And basically, this is a sculpture, and basically that was turned into two dimension on the mosaic and turned into an icon. It's amazing how the Christian experience managed to take a polytheistic, a pagan experience, wasn't afraid of it, and make out of it the best for the most sacred place you could imagine. So it's polytheism turned monotheism.
Yes.
And being at the same time itself. It's amazing.
Wow.
It's amazing.
Beautiful.
Well said. Just one last thing. Mount Athos.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do you get the feel there's a bit of a disconnect now with Mount Athos and the rest of the Greek Orthodox community? Like, for example, the US priest that came out and tried to go, I read in the paper recently that he christened.
The Archbishop
christened
Elpidophoros.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they barred him from allowing to go to Mount Athos.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a bit of a divide now with Christianity and Greek Orthodox and the Vatican?
The Patriarch.
The Patriarch, yeah. Because Mount Athos is very traditional. They're not changing anything.
Yeah. Orthodoxy, the last, let's say, 10 years is going through a crisis on many levels. At the same time, we have developments, very promising developments, and that's the good thing with crises. But it is a crisis. We see that, you know, in the 2016 Synod in Crete and how certain churches, big churches, didn't be part of it. We have seen it, you know, in the war in Ukraine. Generally, you know, the global geopolitical power relations and how the ecumenical patriarchate maneuvers within that space. So it's a very complicated issue. I think that Mount Athos has kept their own balanced sort of position there. Perhaps things might get nastier.
Hope not.
I don't think with the patriarchate, but we don't know how things are going to develop in Greece with the Church of Greece after, you know, the passing of the recent law concerning same-sex marriage. It seems that the Church and the state are going for a head-on crash. It's something that most of us knew that would happen at some point. Times have changed.
Yeah.
It seems that this law has been the catalyst. Now, what's going to come out of it, and if it's going to be for the benefit of Greek society as such, that's a big question. Besides, when we talk about Greek society, we don't know really what we're talking about anymore, because it's not the traditional Greek society we know. I mean, Greece has changed a lot. It's much more multicultural and multi, you know, ethnic than what we believe or imagine. So, yeah, I mean, we just have to wait and see how the clash, because there's going to be a clash between the Church of Greece and the state, how big that is, how it's going to be sort of negotiated, and how Mount Athos is going to react, because Mount Athos, as you know, is something different from the Church of Greece. It doesn't belong to the Church of Greece. It has an autodiigito, which is an autonomy, and it refers spiritually directly to the Patriarchate, but it's within Greece. So it's a bit dodgy as a situation, anyhow.
It's interesting as well, because as most people would have read by now, following the legislation that came in, the vote that came in regarding same-sex marriage in Greece, Metropolitan of Piraea, Seraphim, reacted by calling a synod and promptly excommunicated all the people that were, all the politicians that,
who
that voted yes.
For. Yeah, yeah. But he's not the only one.
Yes. So
yeah, yeah. The Metropolitan in Kythira did the same.
Right.
And the Metropolitan in Kerkyra did the same.
Right.
So there's going to be a sort of a wave of Metropolitans, you know, joining up forces and having their own way of dealing with the issue. Because it seems that Hieronymus doesn't want to have the synod coming out a plan of action, which everyone would have to follow. Perhaps he's a bit cautious as to what such a plan of action would be if he would go for, you know, a vote. So he has left the space open. And in such a space, you know, every metropolitan has the flexibility to do things the way he thinks best.
So to that point, is that something that the Patriarch could step in and say, this is right or this is wrong?
No, he couldn't. You know, in terms of canon law, he couldn't. He could, you know, give his advice. You know, they could ask him, you know, how to deal with it, but not officially.
Right.
Yeah. Of course, he cannot. He cannot intervene into an autocephalous church in such a way. But yeah, I mean, people go to the Patriarch. Metropolitans of Greece go there and they talk. They talk between themselves. So, in that sort of sense, yeah, he could give some sort of advice. But I hope that, you know, as we say in Greek, you know, nane chamili toni. I don't think that, you know, having any sort of how can you say campaigns.
Protests.
Like, you know, we shouldn't make it into a cultural war, you know, sort of thing. The church has its own tradition, has its own life, has its own values. You know, if someone doesn't want to follow them, okay, you don't want to follow them. Now, if that means that, you know, the church and the state have to, at a certain point, you know, start dividing their things and their common endeavors, let it be. Perhaps it's for the best.
Very interesting. Well, turbulent times.
Turbulent, yeah. Interesting times.
Very interesting. Well, it will be very interesting to follow what happens from
how
here.
How that pans out, yeah.
This has been a fantastic discussion. And there's so much more that we genuinely could be talking about. I think
it was due to the Chikudia.
Yeah, it was.
Well, there's only a quarter of a bottle gone. Usually we go, that's not true anymore. We're quite reserved now.
Okay.
When this podcast first started, this whole bottle would be gone.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it sounded like the whole bottle went. We'd be gibbering and the questions would be silly.
Yeah.
I'm feeling it a bit now, actually.
It's a good
one.
It's
actually hit me. Yeah, this is good, though.
We should have had comandaria for this episode.
What's that?
Sacramental wine.
Oh, okay.
Mavrodaphne.
Yes, Mavrodaphne.
Yeah, or Samiotico, the Samos wine, the very sweet one.
Ah, beautiful.
Yeah, very good one.
Oh, Mavrodaphne from Mavrodaphne, your part,
isn't
it?
Yeah, even better.
Yeah.
Classic.
Well,
beautiful.
We're going to have to bring you back at some point.
Yeah,
definitely.
Because there's a whole list of questions here that we that we haven't touched on.
Only got through half, I think.
Yeah.
So.
So episode 2, we'll bring you back and we'll have to we bring a friend maybe.
Yeah.
2.0.
I'll bring a friend along.
That's right.
Classic.
So let's say this is one, and we you know we will have our second.
Second coming.
Second coming. Our sequel. Second round.
That's right.
Exactly. Yeah. And look,
thanks for having me, guys.
Oh, no, thank you. Look, if there's any listeners out there who want to ask some questions to Vasily, please reach out to us, because I'm sure that would have raised a lot of questions for a lot of people.
We're going to receive mail about this. And, you know, let's just say, keep it civil.
It's always, you know, it's always my personal opinion, you know.
Yes.
It's not, though, an arbitrary opinion, because anyone thinks that they have an opinion. But it's an opinion, or it's informed, because I'm dealing with these sort of things my whole life, decades of study. Yeah. So I'm trying, you know, of course, to say what I believe, but not in an arbitrary way, not just, you know, spreading around, you know, things that come to my head, you know.
Absolutely.
And like I said, you're well read. You're well researched. And like I said, I think you could have gone on with one question we've asked. You could have gone for an hour, but we had to cut you off. So I'm sure.
Thank you for that.
No, I'm just saying. So yeah, that's people good, ask that's questions. Good. It might be taken out of context as well. So, but anyway, look, we'd love to hear all your responses out there. Anyone who listens, and I'm sure we're going to have a lot of questions, Tom. So we'll be busy.
Definitely
reaching out to Vasily. Hey, Vasily, how do we answer this?
Well, Vasily, thank you so much for being on Uzo Talk. Really appreciate it. UzoTalk@outlook.com is the email. Follow us on social media at UzoTalk and at Uzo_talk on Instagram. Nika Hanasio, mate. Thank you very much.
Bravo, Tom. Thank you. Thank you, Vasily. Thanks, everyone. See you later.
Ακολουθήστε μας στο Soundees, στο Spotify, στο Apple Podcasts και στο Google Podcasts.